Le capitalisme engendre une dynamique permanente d'accumulation, de crise et d'innovation.
I believe that open markets and free enterprise are the best imaginable force for improving human wealth and happiness.
Je pense que les forces sociales et politiques sont les forces centrales dans la dynamique du capitalisme.
Did you ever have a moment of doubt about capitalism?
Is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed?
How would Smith see the economic world around us?
I think Keynes would have said the problem is the hole in the economy.
Hayek really wrote The Road to Serfdom as a warning.
You always have to be careful with Marx about the one-liners, you know.
Polanyi, for me, was an intellectual earthquake.
I mean, if I had to stereotype Ricardo, I would say he would look like George Soros.
Si vous retournez chez Adam Smith, Marx, Schumpeter, vous avez des embryons de mécanismes vous permettant de comprendre la crise actuelle.
We were told that capitalism is the product of big thinkers and big ideas. But is it true? How did ideas shape our lives? What is their relation to reality? Can they help us understand today's economic crisis, let alone the future of capitalism? Dawn in Nanjing, China's last surviving communist commune. On the surface, a time warp, complete with revolutionary posters and radio news piped into the main square. But the community claims it rediscovered Marx's values as a defense against China's roaring capitalism. London's financial center. Marx is unexpectedly being rediscovered here as well.
And all Marx and Engels' warning over the dangers of monopoly capitalism and concentrated finance have come to pass.
And we thought he was gone forever.
With the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of communism, that system of government was consigned to the dustbin of history, and Marx was thrown out along with it.
So is it possible that we misread Marx? Is it possible that his insight into 19th century capitalism has more relevance now than in past decades? Karl Marx's house in Trier, Germany, besieged by Chinese tourists.
Karl Marx was born in 1818 in the Rhineland, which is the westernmost province of Prussia. It was an interesting part of the Greater Germany because it had been occupied by Napoleon. And so it had been initiated in the ideas of the French Enlightenment. And that was the milieu in which he was raised.
I can feel no regret, wrote a young woman to her loved one. I shut my eyes very tightly. Once again, I lay close to your heart, drunk with love and joy. A romantic love letter like so many others. The innocence of the early 19th century in a provincial German town. The only difference is that the man the letter was addressed to was Karl Marx.
In Trier, he met Jenny von Westphalen. She was quite a catch for Marx because he was the son of a Jewish lawyer and was by such a social outcast. She was the daughter of a Prussian baron.
So he got educated in Trier and then he went to Berlin. I guess the expectation was that he'd go to college and be a good boy and learn law or something like that. He was politically very much engaged because there were always this kind of question of after the French Revolution, would there be sort of liberal democracy? What was going to happen to the autocratic regimes in Germany and so on? So he was kind of mixed up in all of that.
More than a century later, the romantic student from Trier had been transformed into the menace of Western governments and capitalist countries.
Captain Capitalism!
Ah, making out the old Christmas list, I see. Let's see here. World peace, an end to world hunger, free health care. This isn't a Christmas list, son. Who the hell taught you this, child?
Santa did.
Marx had become a boogeyman, the conspirator behind every social demand.
That red suit gives you away, Karl.
Captain Capitalism! So, you discovered my plan. Santa Claus is truly I, Karl Marx, the undead founder of communism.
The reason for this radical transformation from a promising young student into a dangerous revolutionary can be found in the basement of the Trier Museum, kept in a safe.
Das ist das Originalmanifest der Kommunistischen Partei von 1848.
In that year, Europe erupted in popular revolts. It was the moment Marx had been waiting for after years of agitating for radical political reforms. A specter is haunting Europe, opens the Communist Manifesto. The specter of communism. All the powers of Europe have entered into holy alliance to exorcise this specter.
Unfortunately for Marx, he was always late in all of his writing, and he didn't publish the Communist Manifesto until after the 1848 revolts had begun. So he couldn't take credit for those. But in fact, the Communist Manifesto was sort of lost in the revolution and was only rediscovered later.
The story behind the Communist Manifesto did not begin in the 1848 revolution, but in Paris, 5 years earlier, when Marx met Frederick Engels, the revolutionary son of a wealthy industrialist.
They met at a Paris cafe that was known worldwide as being a place where chess masters matched wits. Marx and Engels spent 10 days and 10 nights talking. And at the end of that time, they came out feeling that they were completely in agreement in all things. And the beautiful relationship was born.
Marx meeting Engels was, I think, a crucial moment. He met somebody who was actually engaged in working in the factories of Manchester and therefore could talk to Marx about the labor process.
"They are worse slaves than the Negroes in America," wrote Engels, "for they are more sharply watched, and yet it is demanded of them that they shall live like human beings, shall think and feel like men. This they can do only under glowing hatred towards their oppressors, which degrades them as machines."
Marx went to Manchester with Engels for a little trip in 1845. He saw the people who were living in the most degraded conditions, who were building this industrial future by working in the factories. He saw the families that had been torn apart by the factory work, the mothers who had to give their infants opium in the morning so that they could go off to work and assume that the children are going to be drugged all day and they wouldn't have to be cared for. For a man like Marx, a social and political theorist and an economic theorist, to go there would be to walk right in the laboratory of humanity, of industrial humanity.
While in 1848 the Communist Manifesto was ignored, In 1917, it was the blueprint for the Bolshevik Revolution and its global ambition.
Ever hear of Karl Marx? In his mind, communism was born more than 100 years ago.
Marx has now been transformed into a global threat.
This is the Kremlin, citadel of Russian communism. Looking closer, we see a public display of giant portraits of communist leaders. Here was a new face, but in the background was an old one, Karl Marx.
The Marx that people in the 20th century and the 21st century ran away from was Marx of the Communist Manifesto. That's the person that I think capitalist governments and democracies and Western governments held up as the person who was responsible for communism and its atrocities in the 20th century.
So maybe we got it all wrong. We focused so much on the revolutionary message of the Communist Manifesto and ignored the bulk of the document, which analyzed the real revolution that Marx wrote about, capitalism.
Ladies and gentlemen, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels were the first to chart the uncompromising, unrelenting, compulsively iconoclastic nature of capitalism. It has pitilessly torn asunder the motley feudal ties that bound man to his natural superiors, and has left remaining no other nexus between man and man than naked self-interests, than callous cash payments. And it was Marx who revealed how capitalism would crush languages, cultures, traditions, even nations in its wake. In one word, it creates a world after its own image, he wrote. I would like to suggest to you that Marx has rarely seemed more relevant. Marx's stock resurges on a 150-year tip was how the New York Times, marked the 150th anniversary of the publication of the Communist Manifesto. A text which more than any other, as they put it, recognized the unstoppable wealth-creating power of capitalism, predicted it would conquer the world, and warned that this inevitable globalization of national economies and cultures would have divisive and painful consequences.
After the publication of the Communist Manifesto, Marx was expelled from continental Europe. He was once again a refugee, this time arriving in London in 1849.
Imagine Dean Street in 1850, the year Karl Marx and his family moved into this Soho neighborhood. The streets were teeming with refugees, people who had fled failed revolts on the continent. They arrived in this country, some with only the clothes on their backs, many not even speaking the language. Marx and his family were among the lucky, but all they had, three adults and three children, were two rooms in an attic. And in those cramped quarters, Marx tried to make sense of what he had just experienced and what he saw on the streets around him.
And next door, a brand new exhibition opened right at the time Marx began writing Das Kapital, an exhibition celebrating the achievements of the Industrial Revolution.
It was a triumph of industry. Man's greatest achievements were on display. And so this was the dawn of a new era. King capitalism was on the throne. And yet Marx up in his garret was busily scribbling why the system would never work. Yes, it produced wonders, but it would also produce great destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Das ist das Original, das Kapital von Karl Marx von 1867.
I teach Marx, and the question I always ask is, what can we learn from Marx? And what do we have to do for ourselves? And I think that's a very important question to ask, because very frequently in the past, people have read their Marx and then sort of, I don't know, plugged reality into it and then said, ah, here's the answer. I don't think you can do that. I think there's only a limited set of things we can learn from Marx. Paradoxically, we can't really learn that much about socialism or communism or the future from Marx. We can learn a great deal about how capital works.
The wealth of societies in which capital modes of production prevail presents itself as an immense accumulation of commodities. Our investigation must therefore begin with the analysis of a commodity. Karl Marx, Das Kapital, Volume 1. A commodity is, in the first place, an object outside of us, a thing that by its properties satisfies human wants. Das Kapital.
Oh, well.
While she gets Tom's breakfast, let's take a closer look at that pan. The iron ore for that pan came from the Mesabi Range, so let's start there and see what happened. Maybe it'll give us an idea of just what it is we have.
Now, what Marx does in Volume 1 of Capital is have a little section called The Fetishism of Commodities. And what it basically means is that our daily experience doesn't actually tell us or give us all the information we need to understand how a system is working. Our daily experience is we take some money and we buy a commodity and we take it home. That's our daily experience. But that doesn't tell you anything about the labor that went into the commodity. It doesn't tell you anything about why it is that this commodity costs twice as much as that commodity. And Marx is kind of saying the market system disguises all of those social relations.
There are many different commodities with different use values. But they have only one common property left, that of labor itself, Das Kapital.
The Industrial Revolution, which we conventionally date from around 1780, was founded upon the creation of a factory system with large-scale machinery and, of course, a labor process that was very different from that which artisans making their, cabinets or so on engaged in. This conversion and this rise of industrial capitalism from 1780 onwards was, in Marx's view, a crucial transformation.
The worker is related to the product of labor as to an alien object. The more the worker spends himself, the more powerful becomes the alien world of objects which he creates. The poorer he himself, his inner world, becomes. Karl Marx.
This iPad worker, who asked for his identity to be hidden, has been given a camera to film his life outside the factory. Once, these workers were peasants, with a connection to the land and its products. Now they're part of an assembly line. Alienation, argued Marx, is built into the manufacturing process of commodities.
Chao Shou Yi Pan, to
就是等待用车过来，等待用回家的一种场景。我有时我也会想到，我说自己从家里打工坐着那种，也是跟这种就是火车吧，也是跟这是一样的，载满人的一种车来到广东。就是说是车把你载到那个地方，你就是
to Marx is the idea of living labor, which is so crucial, which distinguishes him very much from the classical political economists who saw labor as a fact of production. They call it a factor of production. It's a thing which gets put into production and then produces something. For Marx, it's not. It's a process. I used to teach introductory geography class, and the first lesson I would say,Can you tell me where your breakfast came from today?
Come on, Bernie, time for breakfast.
Tony Tiger said.
People would say, well, you know, I went to the cafeteria. And I say, okay, well, where did it come from? Well, I went to the supermarket. Where did it come from? Where did it come from? Where did it come from? After a little while, I get them to go back and start to think about the person cutting sugar cane in the Dominican Republic, and that sugar gets on your breakfast table, and you have a relationship with that person who...It's cutting the sugar cane. But the market doesn't tell you anything about that. It disguises all of that.
A lush countryside in India hides what Marx saw as another characteristic of market's expansion, the transformation more and more of life into commodities. This group of cotton growers banded together to fight the invasion of their fields by genetically modified seeds.
Seed in India has been recognized as the source of life. And the very word bija, ja is life. Every ritual is about keeping seed forever.
Those seeds have now been genetically engineered and made into a commodity which farmers are encouraged to buy annually with the promise of higher yield.
Biotechnology, answering the world's call for a better future, today.
For some of these women, the new promise of the commodity of seeds turned into a nightmare. Genetically engineered seeds, which needed to be purchased every year, pushed their husbands into debt.
So they always borrow. They get the seed on credit. Now, the creditors take collateral in terms of the land mortgage. So 2 years later, when a farmer cannot pay back,The new money lender, who is the agent of the seed and chemical companies, comes and says, your land is today mine.
Our PK nahi. Aur agle bachche ko bhi tabiyat barbar nahi rehti thi usko bhi. Wo karja bahut ho gaya tha khet par. Khet pikta nahi tha. Usne aushadhi le liya.
कितना कर्ज आपको नहीं बोला ना कभी
संगीत नहीं दे
they don't tell their wives the seed has got us into debt when they get into debt they are ashamed when they know they're losing their land they're shocked because the bond with the land is still vital for a peasant culture that's the day a farmer will drink pesticide to end their lives and the figure has now hit 260,000 suicidesIt is the greed of capital accumulation that has turned seed into something that has to be bought every year.
that has been turned into a commodity, a consumer product, and the combination of new sources of profit for corporations.
I think that the idea of life as a commodity, really, it's interesting because is a cow a commodity or a pig? I would say they've been commodities for a very long time, and we don't really care about that. So where do we draw the line? And the line may be in human beings. I think what we really worry about is human beings.
And we as a society might have already crossed this line.
Her announcement made headlines around the world. Angelina Jolie underwent a double mastectomy after a genetic test showed she had a mutated BRCA1 gene, giving her an 87% chance of getting breast cancer. Her news put this company, Myriad Genetics, front and center. It has patents on the BRCA1 and 2 genes.
Once life is transformed into a commodity, it is subject to market laws. Investments in genes like those in seeds need to be protected by patent, keeping competition away.
In the system we have in this country and the investment system we have, which many people do think are the reason why we have been the leader for so long in so many areas, that's just the way it works.
So the production of commodities, according to Marx, not only transforms life, it changes our perceptions of nature and of ourselves.
Marx's theory of social change, again, is a process that says ideas have to change, but if the production process doesn't change, then the ideas don't mean anything. The production process can change, but if the ideas don't change, it doesn't mean anything. So we have to, it's the relationship between the production process and the ideas and the social relations and the institutional arrangements, and daily life has to change.
The World Congress on Industrial Biotechnology and Bioprocessing, the world's largest industrial biotechnology event.
The fetish of commodities, according to Marx, masks their role in impacting social change. Barely 60 years ago, scientific innovations were rarely patented and never industrialized in such a way.
1955, a year of anxiety and triumphs. A major medical hurdle was crossed with the discovery by Dr. Jonas Salk of the anti-polio vaccine, which was to spread...
60 years ago, no one talked about patenting the polio vaccine or selling it for a fee.
Who owns the patent on this vaccine?
Well, the people, I would say. There is no patent. This is... Could you patent the sun?
I mean, I can think back to a time when we had ideas, crazy ideas now, about social solidarities. We're all individuals now, you know, and that's what neoliberalism changed.
The 60s caught capitalism completely off guard. How are companies to sell products to a generation that had rejected consumerism? The answer was to tune into the movement and to sell to the individual in everyone. The strategy worked. The marketing machine captured the spirit of 60s individualism and made it its own.
So Marx has what I call a co-evolutionary theory of social change. And to the degree that capital is a permanently revolutionary configuration, so we would see movements in ideas, movements in social relations.
Leaving ideology behind, we now derive a sense of personal identity and empowerment from the goods we purchase and consume. Go on, break the rules, define who you are. With our sneakers.
By the time you get towards the end of Capital, Marx does something interesting. He comes back to the idea of fetishism. And the big fetish is, of course, the money form and the credit system.
Do you have money jitters? Ask the obliging Bank of America for a jar of soothing instant money, M-O-N-E-Y, in the form of a convenient personal loan. Available now at Bank of America.
In order to expand tomorrow's demand and increase profits, today's production needs to be financed.
That means the credit system has to come in here. And what you can derive from this immediately is that the accumulation of capital in the history has always been paralleled by an accumulation of debt. You cannot have one without the other.
A large portion of this money, capital, is always necessarily purely fictitious. That is, title value, just as paper. Karl Marx, Das Kapital.
One of the things that Marx did, I think, very neatly, was to demonstrate fundamental and foundational underlying relations. And that underlying relation between the accumulation of debt and the accumulation of capital can be looked at in a number of very specific ways. I'll give you one example. Tract housing is being built. Where do the builders get the money to do it? They borrow money from a financial institution and say, give me the money and I will buy the land and I will build the housing. Okay? And then there will be a rate of return on that and I'll pay you back. Now, in order for that to happen, they have to be able to sell the housing to somebody. Buyers out there, they go to the same financial institution and say, lend me some money to buy the house that you have financed the production of. This is fictitious capital at work, because the financial institution that has surplus money is actually funding both the production and the consumption of the housing. Right now, we are in a crisis where fictitious capital is all over the place. But what Marx does is this brilliant thing of saying, there's a surface appearance which is the fetish, I'm going to go behind it and actually be able to describe to you the nature of this fetish, which creates this thing called fictitious capital.
Adrian Sobaru could be described as a victim of fictitious capital, a victim of debt which was never his. His story begins here in the Romanian parliament on December 23rd, 2011.
Romania's parliament canceled a no-confidence vote on Thursday after a Romanian electrician staged a one-man protest.
C'était une journée assez particulière parce que il y avait une réunion importante du parlement et on s'attendait à ce qu'il y ait des attaques politiques entre les hommes politiques, le pouvoir et l'opposition. Et puis à un moment donné, nous étions tous dans la rédaction et nous avons entendu une collègue qui a fait "Ah, il s'est jeté."
Doamnelor și domnilor senatori și deputați, distinși colegi, membri ai guvernului.
Et là, il y a eu des bruits un peu bizarres à la télé parce que même les télés qui transmettaient en continu ne s'attendaient pas à ça. On a entendu des bruits, on a vu des images, on ne comprenait pas quoi, on ne savait pas qui s'était jeté, pourquoi, qu'est-ce qui s'était passé.
Urgent, vă rog, urgent, urgent, asistență medicală pentru...
On his t-shirt he wrote, "You have gunned us down. You have killed our children's future. You can take away our money and our lives, but not our freedom."
Dimineața aceea, pe la 3-4 dimineața, m-am trezit din somn și am făcut tricou. Gestul meu nu avea niciun efect fără tricou acela. Știu doar că în momentul în care am zis să fac protestul, înainte să deschid nasturii de la cămașă, fiindcă, practic, nu te certai cu o persoană. Te certai, practic, îți spuneai în spate un sistem. Un sistem care te anulează în orice secundă.
From this tiny apartment in Bucharest, Adrian Sobaru and his wife raised two kids on his small salary of a public TV technician. After 2011, his salary was cut by 25%. And so was the financial help for a special education for Callan, their autistic son.
Nu e ca o nebunie, e, deci, exact în momentul respectiv, cu cu protestul. A fost protest. Ceea ce s-a întâmplat după aceea și așa nu a venit de la el. Dar chiar dacă s-a întâmplat ce s-a întâmplat, nu-i pare rău. Adică poate așa a trezit ceva în cei din jurul lui. Tot speră să tot...
How and why did the debt of his country lead to Adrian Sobaru's desperate act?
That was shocking to all Romanians, I presume. But because this is my way of thinking, I framed that episode, tragic episode, into a much wider frame. For many years, I thought about the way the financial industry has gone, or the derailed high finance and what was not going well. We realized that a growth model based on free movement of capital, total financial liberalization, and overborrowing by the private sector create fragility and create a vulnerability for the economy as a whole that may be very, very painful when when a crisis occurs.
In Romania, foreign capital in search of return flooded Romanian banks, which fueled growth based on debt.
The bankers step in and they helped the consumer growing, and money were flooding into the country. A lot of foreign savings flooding into Romania via banking channels, and they reached the Romanian consumers, and everybody could afford buying new things like cars and houses. And then that people thought that, we have reached the market economy and we can afford more. But actually, there were too much expectation and maybe some false expectations.
Romania now the latest European country wrestling with violent protests over budget cuts and financial issues.
The bubble finally burst here, as everywhere. Debt, as Marx foresaw, is a form of fictitious capital. As a public employee, Adrian was never part of the boom. But when the bubble burst, the state turned against its weakest citizens.
Capital is perpetually moving its crisis tendencies around. If you look at the most recent crisis, it started in the housing market.
If deputies Alan Mathias and Derek Steverson come to your door, your house no longer belongs to you. It belongs to the bank.
It then went to financial institutions.
There's blood in the streets, and no one knows when the bleeding stops.
It then became state debt. It's now being pushed onto the people. But people are not in a position very frequently to bear that, so it's now moving back to financial institutions in some instances. Marx is, I think, very good at giving us a sense of how this moves around. And as it moves around, of course, it engages in a process of destruction.
On the far end of the global trail of the tsunami of fictitious capital in search of return is India, one of the world's largest emerging markets.
The term emerging markets emerges in the late 1980s, early 90s as well. And it's actually coined by people at the World Bank and the IMF in order to describe those economies which are going to be growing very rapidly. Now, why are they so concerned about growth? Not just because they believe that growth will address poverty. But they are interested, above all, in the quantitative measure of growth. What's the reason for that? If you examine deep enough, you find that if the real economy, instead of 5% per annum, let's say GDP in these areas is growing at 8 or 9%, the returns to financial investors in financial markets actually grow by orders of magnitude greater. So India in 2009 was third most lucrative stock market. The Bombay Stock Exchange was actually yielding annual returns of, on average, about 48%, which is remarkable. So what you actually notice is that India has become an outpost of global finance, of global finance capital.
Finance capital, which Marx called fictitious, is said to have lifted around 200 million people up to the middle class, but left behind an estimated 800 million more, surviving on $1 a day.
Je pense que le monde dans lequel on est en ce début du XXIe siècle ressemble beaucoup au monde qu'observe Marx au XIXe siècle. Il y a un vrai souci par rapport aux inégalités de son temps dont les économistes d'aujourd'hui feraient bien de s'inspirer. C'est-à-dire que ce qui alimente quand même l'inquiétude marxiste et plus généralement les mouvements communistes et socialistes qui se développent dans la deuxième partie du 19e siècle, c'est la très grande stagnation salariale.
Stagnation so severe that in the United States, for example, a CEO was making 20 times more than his employees in the 1950s. In 2000, his salary ballooned to 120 times. And in 2013, it almost doubled again to 204.
Donc, on se retrouve aujourd'hui au 21e siècle avec une réalité qui était en fait celle du 19e siècle et des siècles précédents, à savoir une croissance structurellement lente, un rendement du capital structurellement plus élevé que la croissance. Et contrairement à ce que pensait Marx, ça ne va pas se résoudre tout seul. C'est-à-dire qu'il ne va pas y avoir une fin naturelle à ce processus par le simple fait de force économique. Ce processus peut continuer indéfiniment.
This is CNN breaking news.
It was a Monday morning like none other in the 158-year history of financial giant Lehman Brothers. The company went bankrupt.
If capitalism is not on its deathbed, as Marx predicted, then what could be an alternative theory to explain the 2008 financial crisis and its aftermath?
We recognize that the very nature of globalization, which creates ever higher standards of living, also is a process which we call creative destruction. The problem with creative destruction is that it is destruction.
Creative destruction was a term coined by the early 20th century economist Joseph Schumpeter.
Schumpeter's key idea of creative destruction was the idea that capitalism is constantly revolutionizing itself from within. He called it a process of industrial mutation, where there's incessant change, destroying the old, bringing in the new. And the agent of this change, the person who carried this change out, is the entrepreneur.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
So the basic idea of creative destruction is that there's a new product, that's the creative side, or a new method of producing, and that's all to the good, but there's also the destruction side, which is that it wipes out some earlier method or product, and there's a loss there. There's a social loss, there's a human loss. Schumpeter didn't pay quite as much attention to the loss side as to the creative side.
Today we celebrate the first glorious anniversary of the information purification collectives. We have created, for the first time in all history, a garden of pure ideology.
Je crois que Schumpeter partageait avec Marx l'idée que le capitalisme est dynamisme. Et, par exemple, dans son histoire de l'analyse économique, Schumpeter attaque complètement les théories de l'équilibre. Il n'y a pas d'équilibre. Le capitalisme, c'est le déséquilibre permanent. Donc il est en complet accord avec Marx.
We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause. We shall prevail.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
Pour lui, le déséquilibre est créé par le fait que des entrepreneurs inventent des nouveaux processus, des nouveaux produits, des nouvelles commercialisations qui déstabilisent l'ancien système. Donc, il complète Marx par le fait qu'en plus de l'accumulation, il y a le fait que le capitalisme, par son innovation, détruit lui-même la valeur du capital passé.
So are we in the midst of a crisis which is part of an endless cycle of creative destructions? Or in the midst of a system which, as Marx predicted, is indeed in a terminal downward spiral?
It was probably the weekend before Lehman's went bust, and it's normally a little bit noisy, but at the time it was, you could hear a pin drop. It was that deathly quiet, and I could almost feel, you know, that the global system was frozen. And it was quite a scary thought. It took me back to a lot of the things that I used to read about and study when I was much younger, the days when I actually read Marx for fun.
And all Marx and Engels' warning over the dangers of monopoly capitalism and concentrated finance have come to pass. So why then no total collapse of capitalism? Because right around the world, governments have been forced to bail out the so-called free market. We have bailed out the banks, we have subsidized industries, we've sorted out the insurance sector, we've underpinned financial services. It is the forces of collectivism which have saved capitalism.
In 1991, socialism died, at least communism in the Eastern Bloc. In 2008, capitalism died. When I was a young student of economics, the great debate was between socialists who believed in central planning and Hayekians or liberals who believed in the miracle of the market in organizing economic activity. The argument of the pro-market theorists was that capitalism is a Darwinian struggle where the fittest prevail and the less fit, the more inefficient, the least productive and profitable perish.
The New York State Attorney General says that Citigroup, Merrill, and seven other banks, which got $175 billion in tax-funded bailout money, paid out $33 billion in bonuses.
Well, what happened after 2008 with the particular ways in which the bankers were saved was Darwinism inverted. The more unsuccessful you were as a banker, the greater your bank's losses, the greater the support you got from the taxpayer, and the more successful you became at extracting from the rest of society the surplus that the rest of society was producing. So we have a new regime which I call bankruptocracy. It's the rule by bankrupted banks.
The whole point about the contradictions of capitalism is not specifically whether Marx's analysis is relevant, which personally I think in many ways it is, but it's the outcome, it's the synthesis, and our capacity to basically nurture and establish coping mechanisms. On Marx's tombstone, as you'll know if you've been there, there's an inscription taken from the Theses on Feuerbach, which says, "The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it," which is precisely what our antecedents have done by developing coping mechanisms like institutions of the rule of law, limited liability companies, trades union, mutual societies, insurance, welfare, and technological discoveries that drive productivity, income, and jobs. Finding those coping mechanisms is an endless task, and we need to make more progress.
In
Marx finally finished Das Kapital, he had watched his wife become ill, his daughters suffer ill health and poverty. He had buried now 4 children by the time Das Kapital was published. And the family waited for the recognition that they all believed he deserved for a book that they thought would not only change their lives, but would change the world. And nothing happened. When Das Kapital was published, Engels and the family frantically started writing reviews in order for it not to be ignored. But their reviews were the only ones really that were written.
Marx never really recovered. He died on March 14th, 1883, 2 years after Jenny. Only 11 people showed up at his funeral. Friedrich Engels eulogized him. On the afternoon of the 14th of March, 1883, at 3:15, Engels said, "The greatest living thinker ceased to think."
The Marx family was originally buried in a very small and modest plot in here in Highgate, just down the road from where the monument is today. In 1956, the Communist Party decided that Marx, such a monumental figure, really deserved a larger memorial.
Трудящиеся Англии чтят память основоположника научного коммунизма Карла Маркса.
And so they built this. And in a way, I think this really is a very good indication of what happened to Marx's legacy, Marx's ideas, how it was interpreted and misinterpreted in the 20th century.
In 1929, capitalism seemed to be on its knees, and Marx's prediction came closer to fulfillment than ever. Two individuals had diametrically opposed ideas of how to save capitalism from itself. The debate between them has shaped the past century and is still raging today.